Ralph Waldo Emerson really has everything to do with unity and new thought. And it's not a sentimental thing. It's very, very specific and notion like that which is behind us, meaning the past, or in front of us being the future, is insignificant to what is within us. And when he was speaking about that, he was talking, referencing specifically the Jesus teaching that the kingdom of God is within. Now, however you know that, whatever you call it, whatever other words are meaningful to you, Christ potential, or in the words of our friend Deepak Chopra, the infinite unbounded field of your potentiality. We're talking about exactly the same thing. And the gift of Emerson to our culture was that he was able to articulate the perennial philosophy, the great, profound, common spiritual truths regarding human consciousness in relation to the divine. And he did it at a time which was right at the beginning, let's say, of being able to deal with it in a different kind of way. He was born in 1803. He died in 1883. He was very famous in his lifetime, rock star famous, and yet he was a philosopher, he was a speaker. That was his job. That's how he earned his living. He started out as an ordained a Unitarian minister, which is not the same thing as unity. He was a Unitarian minister, having attended the Harvard Divinity School, and Harvard University was founded as a seminary, like all the early universities were seminaries. That's why they were established, and Harvard was a Unitarian seminary. Princeton was a Presbyterian seminary, and Yale was an Anglican seminary. The little things you learn when you come to church, you know? It's interesting. So he did graduate, and divinity school in those days was not what it is now. He was pretty young when he graduated, and yet he was a spiritual genius, but not an academic one. He went to school for a couple of years, studied divinity. That's what he focused on, and became a Unitarian minister like his father before him, and they lived in Boston. He married a young girl, I think she was 19 at the time, and immediately, like within a month of their marriage, she became very ill and she died within a year. And this was a defining experience for the rest of his life. He never quite got over that loss. He gave up his pulpit while he was still a young man. I think he was in his late 20s. And he gave it up because he felt that he was out of integrity with what the establishment was requiring for effective, customary ministry at that time. And the Unitarians of the 1830s are not the same as they are now. It's a vastly different culture, even though there are some continuities that still exist. But he came into great conflict with the folks, I guess that was his board, there, because he didn't want to participate in the Lord's Supper, which is also called communion, and thought that ritual was a distraction to what the essential work of preaching is. And so he gave up his ministry and became a speaker. That's what he did. He was kind of like Oprah. In a way, he was had a spiritual message, but not a church. And again, he was vastly influential. My favorite description of him is that he was the only iconoclast, which means an institution destroyer. He was the only iconoclast who was never martyred in his time. And he was deeply revered, considered a living saint, really, in his own lifetime. A few years after he gave up his pulpit, he was invited, because he was a graduate in good standing, back to the Harvard Divinity School to give the address to the boys that were graduating. At that time, it was July 1838, so that makes him 35 years old. So he was about 6 years out of the pulpit at that point. And he gave a message, small class. You know, it's not like it is now. Maybe there were a dozen boys who were graduating. But he gave an address which rocked the establishment at the time. And he got in a whole lot of trouble for it. Became persona non grata on the campus for decades. What he said is in this thing, which is called the Divinity School Address, and the language, admittedly, is very archaic. I'm going to read about three sentences, and I will translate as I go. You appreciate that? Yeah. And it is English, but it's very difficult to understand. He was trying to prove a point that there was really, really important work for young ministers to do. But it was his opinion that established religion had gotten off course. He says, whilst the doors of the temple stand open night and day before every man, and the oracles of this truth cease never, it is guarded by one stern condition, this, namely, it is an intuition. Meaning, while there are churches everywhere that are open night and day, and at that point they're publishing a lot, they're preaching a lot, there's a great revival going on in the country. In the 1830s, the truth that he is talking about is the Jesus teaching truth, which is the kingdom of God is within. It is an intuition. It is an inner, unique knowing. No matter who the preacher is, the only thing that is truly true in the really real world of the eternal is that the kingdom, the wisdom, the truth lies within every person. There is no mediating power that any kind of clergy has. He goes on to say about this intuition, your inner knowing, your inner kingdom, it cannot be received at second hand. This one sentence here is the first line of text that gives rise to the term new thought. Because it cannot be somebody else's opinion that you accept as true. It has to be a new thought for you. It cannot be transmitted and received as somebody else's learning. You have to intuit it, know it yourself, and when you know it, you have it forever. This is what new thought really means. Truly speaking, it is not instruction but provocation that I can receive from another soul. The work of the preacher, he uses the term preacher throughout this essay, truly speaking, it is not instruction but provocation that I can receive from another soul. I, the teacher, the preacher, can't tell you anything, but can provoke you to wake up to the truth, to the kingdom that resides in its fullness in you. So it's a work of exhortation. There is no dogma to learn. That's all made up. And doctrine, whatever they are ideas about best practices that may be relevant for one group of nomads 4,000 years ago, but are they relevant for you today? There is no dogma or doctrine that can be taught But the great work of spiritual awakening has to occur within you. Intuition, inner learning. What he announces, preacher, what he announces, I must find true in me or wholly reject on his word, be he who he may, I can accept nothing. It doesn't matter how important this person looks, what they're wearing, if they're the Pope or the whatever, I don't care who they are or how important they think they are by the title that they think they have earned. They have no special insight about the ultimate ongoing reality that is yours to experience. If the preacher can excite in you a feeling that all is well, life is good, and we are truly blessed, even when our life is accompanied by challenges that are hard and sad, if a preacher can excite that in you, that you can continue to remember it, then you've got it. It's your kingdom that you get to live in. But if what they talk about doesn't make you pleased with the privilege of leading your own life, then be done with it. Say, you know what? That was great for me when I was 5, you know, and it's not great now. The art of living skillfully and gracefully is then in not trash-talking or backfiring. So we learn how to do that, maybe, sometimes. But if we're complete, like with any relationship, if we're complete, you know, you get to move on and go in the direction, quote unquote, of your greater good and forget about everything else. Forget about it. Because if you want to give yourself the opportunity to create a life that you want to live, what I have learned is I don't have a minute to waste on somebody else's shortcomings or their philosophy. I have to give every conscious minute I have to what I want to experience or create. If it doesn't work for you, move on. And there's a subtext which is very rich in all of this as well, which means stop trying to justify things that make no sense. Which is why individually I've never been particularly interested in metaphysical Bible interpretation. If it doesn't make sense, move on to something that makes sense and spend your time there rather than trying to make sense of something that doesn't make any sense to you. You're a grown-up. If it's a construct that you want to work with, great. But if not, move on. There's wisdom and joy everywhere. Have at it. Have at it. Emerson in this essay goes on, you know, because he really, again, he really thought he was doing something good. Imagine his surprise. And he was saying that this is really, really, really important work, that the message of Jesus is a unique revelation. Well, in 1838, it may have been. We now know that it was not a unique revelation. It is the perennial philosophy. But all these other wisdom traditions hadn't been translated yet. They were just beginning to translate them, and mostly they were still in German. By the end of his life, the Vedas had been translated, all the works of Buddha had been translated. By the 1880s, they were in English, but they weren't at this time. But he says that Jesus had a unique, he was a unique philosopher. He belonged, I think the word was, he belonged to a unique race of prophets. And that it was he alone that understood there was an infinite potential of every human being. And that Jesus got it. And that's why he spoke about Jesus. No ritual. He didn't build his own church. He didn't start anything. He was an itinerant preacher on purpose. And interestingly, that's what Emerson chose to be as well. An itinerant freelance speaker. And did so for 50-something years. successfully. Unity wouldn't have been able to get a foothold if it hadn't been for the benevolent or receptive climate that Emerson helped establish. And New Thought was a very known thing, more known in the general population than it is now in the 1880s, 90s, 1900, 1910. It was more well known. He felt that there was important information to get out and spent his whole life looking at the world exactly as it is and making the effort to see himself in relationship with it and the divine and led a successful, effective, and happy life. Now, you can look at this example in one of three ways. Literally, which means that's where our philosophy comes from. It's great to know that. I'm dedicated to lifelong learning. I think it's instructive to not think that unity is some weird one-off woo-woo thing, but it has deep philosophical American roots. I kind of like that. I like knowing that. You can appreciate the teaching for what it is and see how it keeps coming up even in songs that we sing. This is brilliant. It can be instructive as well for all other aspects of life, meaning whenever any institution seeks to tell you what you need to do to get along, there is always that in you that has a kind of wisdom and is attached to a part of the divine spark, the flow of life, the life principle, the healing principle. If a doctor tells you no way you're going to recover from this, that may be their opinion, but it might not be the truth. If your financial advisor says you're toast, you might as well give up now. You can collapse to that reality and be a nervous wreck. Or you can say, I get that. You're looking at a certain set of facts, and yet there might be another opportunity on the side of this that I can look at. Could there not be? And the answer is, of course. Don't give your power away, is the teaching that we embrace, which we are direct linear descendants of Emerson in that way. Do not give your power away. And as George Fox taught in 1650, question authority. That is not a hippie bumper sticker that appeared in the 1960s. It's a teaching of George Fox, because there is that of God in all people. The light divine is a part of all people. You question authority. It doesn't mean poke them in the eye. It means if somebody tells you something, you think about it and you go, really? And if the answer is no, not for me, you go, oh, thank you for sharing. Goodbye. This is applicable in all phases of life. One of the things that Emerson was... I'm opening the door. Get a little air. Talk amongst yourselves. One of the things that Emerson took on that he felt was very important, and he did it in a skillful way, was that he felt it was so crucial to free people from the oppression of religious superstition, a dogma and ritual-based way of being. And you know, dogma and ritual are the foothold, perhaps for most people on this planet. It's the foothold that their souls require in this lifetime, and that's fine. But if it is not life-giving and life-enhancing for you, it does become an oppression. And even as Stevie Wonder reminds us in his song Superstition, if you believe in things you don't understand, you will suffer. He gave his work life, teaching life, speaking life, to alert us and to provoke every one of us, not to instruct us, to lay something on you, but as Buddha says, as Jesus says, as every great teacher says, wake up. And the waking up is only really about wake up to your sense of self, of your inherent dignity and worth. Forget about what anybody else says about you, your condition, your entitlements, your relationships, your whatever. Forget about it. But wake up to your own sense of life, your own kingdom, whatever that is. And walk in that direction. Go for it. Go for a life that you have imagined but not yet experienced. That was the great work of the preachers, Emerson was telling the graduating class. Don't lay anything on them and tell them what they have to believe. Tell them to wake up and be happy in the day. This is the day the Lord has made. Rejoice, be glad in it. Do something! And if you don't, you don't. Okay. You have another lifetime somewhere, I guess, in some incarnation. And we're all souls. We're all going in an expansive direction. You can do it now or later, I guess. But if you're here, you're a type of person, I think, that wants to do more. And Emerson wanted this little class of preachers to know that they had a great opportunity to tell people to stay awake and encourage them in the direction of their own good. And that's the work that I've chosen for myself. Because I can't do anything more than that. I don't know anything more than that. It didn't occur to me that I could be a minister until I realized that that was the work I got to do. I thought you had to know everything so you could tell everybody all the information. And then I thought, oh, I get to live, experiment by principle that we teach, and I get to tell you when I fail and how I got over it. Go in the direction of your good. Many decades ago, when I worked at the National Endowment for the Arts, I ran a small grant-making program that was called The Crafts, and we dealt with a lot of universities and Native American communities, and as well as artists who were doing things for architecture and everything in between. And on one panel, because we would invite experts to review the grant, staff didn't decide who got money. You would invite experts in to review requests and then make grants. There was a man who had been asked to serve on the panel whose name was David. And when I met him, I introduced myself to him and I said, David, tell me what you do. And he said, I build spaces that place the spirit at the threshold of its possibilities. And I never forgot that. That impressed me forever. He said, I build spaces that place the spirit at the threshold of its possibilities. He could have said, I'm a general contractor working in the Bay Area specializing in traditional Japanese joinery. He could have said that, but he had a vision of his art and his life as a ministry for 30 years I've remembered that, and that has been a banner that I have walked beneath in terms of my own work, the job of having this building. The things that we call ministry is really important because it's a place where we gather to share disappointments and successes, laughter and tears. But it is the threshold where I, in an Emersonian kind of way, would encourage you to stay awake to your potential. And if this itself were the very threshold, I would stand portal by it and say, come, please. Don't be satisfied yet with your attainment, but come, please, step over the threshold into a new, larger experience of your wholeness and your health and your creativity. And of course, we know what happens every time you take a step in that direction. The threshold kind of moves back farther and farther. So you are always going to be walking in a direction of greater good than where you are right now. But the instruction that Emerson gave me as an inheritor of the work is, no matter where the threshold is to be welcoming and to say, please, yes, because it is safe. It may not be required, but it is safe and it is worth the effort. This is the only game there is in human life. For saying something so innocuous like that, he was vilified by the establishment, and they refused by law to allow him on the campus at Harvard. And of course, after 30 years, that became counterproductive because Emerson was so famous they wanted to claim him as their own, so they invited him back and gave him a doctorate degree. Same as it ever was. He didn't let that discourage him. He went ahead and he created his world. It's been the privilege and the pleasure of my life to stand at this threshold for the last 4 years, to remind myself first and always to stay awake to the kingdom that is within, and then to exhort, to excite, to provoke you through any number of wacky, crazy, banana ways, whether it be blessing bicycles or singing show tunes, but that you are a perfect expression of life entitled to a full life of joy, and to keep going in that direction. I hope it won't be 30 years before I'm here again. But it has been an extraordinary blessing. And I take great inspiration from all of you, the ones that I know and the stories that I know, of how I have seen you handle life and continue on with great faith and joy. All is well. That's all I know. All is well. Let's conclude with prayer, shall we? I invite you to close your eyes right now and to know that no matter what, life is good. That there are opportunities, there are blessings all around us. There are things that we cannot imagine, but we will experience if we step over the threshold of our own limitations. Your spirit is poised for growth at every moment of the day and night, even in your sleep. There's important spiritual work that can be done. But together we have the confidence to advance confidently in the direction of our good, knowing that every time we take one step, the Beloved will take 1,000 steps towards us, and we will find ourselves on higher ground. And always aware, that for as long as we're here, be it another week or another 100 years, that this is a gift. And it's wise to use it and be grateful for it. I know that everyone here in this ministry knows that in some part of their being, that divine spark part of their being, and embraces it and celebrates life and the promise of living. So it is. Amen.